Good morning. My name is Keegan Rasko, and I'd like to welcome you to Life Downstream. Life Downstream is a radio show where I, a high school student, and my high school English teacher, Mr. Andrew Morgan, talk to interesting people from around the area about their life experiences and how those life experiences allowed them to learn outside of a classroom. And with that, I'll pass it over to Mr. Morgan to introduce our guest for today.
We are here today with Asher Clover. Asher is a senior at Astoria High School. Asher, thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I'm excited.
Yeah, cool. So before the show started, we talked about a couple different topics. And one of the things that we talked about when I asked you, you know, what are some moments or chapters of your life that you feel like taught you something? Mm-hmm. One of the first things that came to your mind was your experience with gender and thinking about gender. So you identify as non-binary. You prefer to use they, them pronouns. Can you tell us a little bit about what this process was like to kind of be really reflective about your own gender and to come to this kind of understanding about your gender?
Yeah, absolutely. So my whole kind of gendery type experience started honestly in first grade. Someone said I had really short hair because my older brother had cut it all off.
Okay.
Christmas Eve, he took a pair of scissors, cut off like all of my hair. I had like an inch left on all of my head. Oh. And so someone said I look like a boy, and I was like, you know, I don't completely mind that idea. I kind of like the idea that I don't look one way or the other. But I blew it off. Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't.
Do you remember how old you were when that happened?
Oh, it was first grade. I was like 7,
okay.
8.
Okay.
I think I was closer to 8.
Okay. Maybe
first,
six,
second
seven,
grade,
eight.
Somewhere like that.
Okay.
So, like, flash forward 7th grade, that's when, like, I was dating someone who was non-binary. And it was really weird to talk to them and be like, I relate to this more than I thought that I would ever relate to something in my entire life.
And if folks aren't familiar with the term non-binary, what's the easiest way to define it? How would you
non-binary is basically anything outside of the strict genres of like boy or girl. Mm-hmm. So gender, in my belief, is not only a social construct, that's a big belief of mine, but it's also a spectrum. So there's more than just boy and girl. There's everything in between, and there's the void of none at all. So non-binary is anything that's not that strict boy-girl kind of phase.
Mm-hmm.
And I personally identify in the void of it. So agender would be the specific term, but I like to use non-binary because I feel like I float sometimes.
Okay. So you feel like this is something that kind of like over time gradually emerged, or you were able to kind of like articulate it and kind of think about it. I don't want to say more clearly, but it was this process. It wasn't this like, oh, this is how I identify. It was this.
Yeah, it wasn't a sudden thing. It was definitely years and years and years of kind of evaluating myself and who really am I. For me to be, and there was a time in my life where I tried to identify hyper femme, like hyper femme, because I wanted to try and hide the fact that there was any quiver in my gender. And so I had really long hair, and I presented like as you would expect, like a super feminine little girl to dress. And it wasn't until 7th grade that I'm like, okay, I'm going to ditch the dresses. I'm going to wear jeans and band t-shirts and hoodies all the time. And I'm going to become this little punk rock kid.
Was there a catalyst for that? Do you remember like a moment where you're like, you know what? I'm going to do things this way now. Like, was there a specific, you know, event that kind of sparked that or not?
I think it was dating someone who was non-binary, who was trans. I think it was the looking and seeing, okay, if somebody else can do this, if somebody else can find their grounding and find themselves in such a way, why couldn't I? And so, yeah, I ended up cutting off all my hair in like 7th grade. And I've kept it pretty short since then. I grew it out shoulder length, but then that gave me so much dysphoria. Dysphoria being like when you're trans and you feel like you're in the wrong body and you hate everything about that. And it's like this internalized, it makes you want to throw up constantly because you're so disgusted by who you are and the body that you're in. So having longer hair gave me that. So I cut it all off and I've kept it short since then.
Can you tell us a little bit about you know, settling on using they, them pronouns and just the idea of pronouns and why that's kind of such an important concept to you.
Yeah. So pronouns to me are a staple of who you see yourself as and who you expect others to see you as. So if someone was male to female trans, you wouldn't call them a he, right? Hmm. You would call them a she because that's how they identify. If you're male to female, you are solidly a she. And people don't get that way about non-binary people. They think that it's strictly like, oh, you were a girl, but you don't identify as one, but you still look like one, so I'm still going to call you a girl.
Hmm.
And I think that that's really invalidating because I put so much thought and so much internalized processing into my gender and into who I am. It's really hard that when people completely throw that off, like, I've spent so much time building who I am, spent so much time processing and analyzing and going through my own head, trying to determine who is Asher, that to not be recognized as that, like finding they, them pronouns and finding that singular term that set me apart from the societal construct of gender, it was revolutionary to me. It was like, it was liberating to be able to find myself.
It's a really interesting idea to frame it in this way. I think where you're saying, cause you know, I haven't thought about this issue before in a way where we're saying, all right, if you use the pronouns that somebody is preferring, then you are validating the identity they have worked so hard to navigate and to construct or to adopt. But it's this idea of not just validation, but you've put in all this work. And when people use the pronouns that you're asking them to use, it's a way to kind of honor that work and honor that thinking. And it's just a, I don't know, it's kind of a different way to think about it that I think, you know, I don't know if everybody thinks about that notion when they are using pronouns, right?
No, I don't think they do, because most of the time people just look at someone and they're like, oh, that's a girl, or oh, that's a boy.
Mm-hmm.
And people look at me and they're like, oh, that's a girl. And I'm like, sorry, you're wrong. Yeah. But I present the way that I do as almost a form of self-protection.
Tell me a little more about that. What do you mean by that?
So there's such a high rate of bullying and of murder in the trans community that I'm so scared for my own safety as to present as someone who might identify without binary, that in order to protect myself, in order to feel safe and like I have a place in society, I have to misgender myself in how I present. Not saying that I don't enjoy femme things. I love doing makeup. I love dresses. But there's more times that I wish that I could present otherwise.
Do you feel like, is any of that like location specific? And you think, okay, in the future, if I move to fill in the blank place, then I won't need to do this. And this is a temporary thing. Or in your mind, do you imagine that this is like a semi-permanent kind of way of being that you just will have to always have your own protection on your mind?
It feels not so much location, but more societally. And until we as a society can change, until we as a society can withhold a belief, not withhold, but like foster a belief of love of another, until we as a society can truly envelop ourselves with another person and believe that everyone is seen as equals, that until that point is reached, I think I have to protect myself and have to worry about my own self-preservation above anything else.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's really hard to find someone who truly accepts you when you're non-binary.
Hmm. Before the show, we had talked a little bit about how, you know, when I asked you, what do you feel like you've learned from this process of thinking about your gender? You said it's really important to find out who you are despite what you hear around you, despite mm-hmm. what society tells you, right? So could you tell us a little bit more about that? It almost sounds like in the face of danger, right? In the face of threats that the trans community specifically has to kind of endure, it's still worth it in your mind, right, to go through this process, to find out who you really are. Can you tell us a little more about that?
Yeah, above all else, you need to find who you are. Above all else, there needs to be a love of self. And in order to love yourself, you need to truly accept who you are. And people are going to push you down for that. People are going to say that what you're doing is not okay, that your existence is not okay. But even though you're going to have that pushback, you may not have to present that way. You may not have to present as the gender you identify as, but you need to find it in yourself and realize this is who I am. And it might be dysphoric to not present that way, but you need to know. I think even cis people could do with thinking about their gender every now and again.
Hmm.
Because I think everyone should play with the idea of gender. I think everybody should play with the idea that maybe there's a little bit beyond what they're taught.
Hmm.
My favorite quote, I apply it to self-love, but it's the greatest thing you'll ever learn is just to love and to be loved in return. And I think in order to love yourself and to get that love in return from yourself, you need to know who you are.
Hmm.
And knowing who you are, is gender is a huge part of that.
Hmm.
What about when you're going through your daily life and you're having some, I don't know, maybe a bad day or mm-hmm. some certain events happen? What are the saving graces that you find at a high school or in your community or, I don't know, those people who can help you get through the day or pick up your mood?
So when I having rough days, having days where I disassociate,
mm-hmm.
so like there are times where I feel like I'm floating 6 feet above where I actually am. In order to ground myself, in order to find, yes, there's a better thing. I don't have many friends here. I don't have a big community here. But I do turn to, like, teachers. I turn to my coworkers. I turn to regulars at work, even. I try and find an escape from that. I love going to work, even if I'm not working that day. I love going to the place that I work. I work at Godfather's downtown. I love going there because it teaches me that I have a place. It reminds me that I have a grounding somewhere, that there's somewhere that people enjoy being around me because obviously there are regulars who come back day after day, and if they hated me, they wouldn't come back on my shift.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to ask a little bit about, to come back to this language idea. You know, I'm an English teacher and I'm really interested in language and the evolution of language. And so I noticed in the last year, I think now there were more than one kind of major dictionary has come out this last year and chosen the singular version of they mm-hmm. as their word of the year. And so if you're not familiar with this, you know, dictionaries will add words to the dictionary every single year. And there's always this kind of annual discussion about the new words and these new terms. And it's, you know, it's kind of further proof and evidence of how language shifts and changes right out from mm-hmm. under our feet. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, I guess this came up a little bit already where you were talking about safety and what sort of world, you know, you hope to be in the future. But when you look at what's happening with pronouns and with language, specifically around gender, what trends are you kind of like keeping your eye on? Where do you think, if you had to make guesses as to kind of what this is going to look like in another 5 or 10 years, where do you see this conversation going?
I think singular they to me is a huge, huge part of my life. Being able to identify with that, being able to see myself as that. And I think it's amazing that we're at a place in the world where that can be the word of the year. But there's still so much pushback, so much backlash from people who I would consider to be close friends or previously have, who have been against it, and that's not a safe person for me anymore. So I think it's really important for those words to be out in the public so that you can see who truly stands by you. But I'm hoping that in 5-10 years, society can be at a place where it's common vernacular.
Hmm. Do you feel like if you had to articulate what is the pushback? Like what is the, you know, if people are kind of refusing to use they, them when they interact with you, I don't know, is it just too different of a thing? Or what would you say you've kind of heard over the years as like people's argument against using the pronoun that you're asking them to use?
The main argument that I've heard is that it's not grammatically correct.
Mm.
But I respond to that with, well, it's in the dictionary now. And if someone drops their wallet on the street, you pick up the wallet. You don't say, huh, I wonder if he or she is missing this. You go, yeah. Huh, I wonder if they're missing this.
Yeah, yeah.
People use they singularly in their day-to-day life. And they don't realize it.
Huh, interesting.
But then when they're asked to call somebody singular they, it's automatically this idea that they've never heard of that is so outlandish that they could never possibly do anything like that.
Yeah. One of the articles I read about this recently, in this kind of conversation about dictionaries, you know, focusing on it, talked about how there is a historical precedent for mm-hmm. singular use of they, and I also kind of read that example or similar example of, you know, if somebody forgets their phone in a restaurant or something,
yeah.
no one would say, I think he or she left his or her phone over at that table, right? You know, so yeah, I've kind of heard that example
yeah.
before, but, can you tell us in talking about language and kind of this importance of language for you in your life, tell us a little bit about, getting back into poetry. I know you're really into poetry. We'll talk a little bit about the slam that's coming up. Mm-hmm. But tell us why poetry, what value does poetry have for you? What have you learned from poetry?
So I write constantly. I always keep a journal on me. I'm journaling some pens. Buy a new journal every month. And they're always pretty journals. Mm-hmm. Because I think writing should be sacred.
Mm-hmm.
And poetry, it leads me through my emotions. It leads me through what I'm feeling. The thoughts that I'm having. Not necessarily even tangible ideas. It's telling me, not necessarily telling me, but it's helping me guide through everything. Every little thing in life, whether it's minor, whether it's major. I have a reoccurring theme in my poems of the butterflies in your stomach, because that's not a tangible idea. And most people would blow it off as anxiety. But I think that they're these beautiful creatures. And my butterflies teach me so much. And that's my main topic of writing, is these butterflies in my stomach and what they teach me.
You mentioned the word guide. If you didn't write, what would happen at this stage of your life? If you went 6 months without putting a single word down on the page, what do you think would happen? You can't see it right now, but Asher is shaking their head.
I would implode, literally. I think that without poetry, without writing in any way, shape, or form, I wouldn't have any way to express myself. I would be this constant ball tumbling through life without any way to seek where I'm going. It would be like walking through a cavern without a flashlight or without a torch.
When you write something, do you feel like after you've written it, now all of a sudden you have more clarity and you understand an idea now that you see it in words?
Yeah, I do.
Why is that?
I don't know. I think so. I see things in words. I think in words. When I'm thinking a thought in my head, I don't see it in a picture. I think it written in cursive. Which is weird, apparently. I didn't know other people don't think like that until recently.
But one of the things that I thought was really interesting, and you kind of spoke my language because I'm a musician, but you chose major and minor as kind of descriptions for whatever it was you're writing about.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, do you pick a mode or a style of writing before you write, or does it just
Oh, no, I just
fall?
Jump in.
Interesting. And
so I never plan out any of my work except my autobiography, because I'm also writing an autobiography. So I never plan any of it out. I have a thought. I have a phrase in my head usually. It usually starts with a phrase, and that gets me going. And I can write, six pages about this one phrase.
And the other thing that I found interesting, and I used they this time, plural, to describe butterflies, the butterflies that you talk about. I'm wondering, how often does this kind of struggle with your identity, not necessarily a struggle, but this kind of relationship with your identity, how often does that end up kind of sewing itself either consciously or unconsciously into your writings?
Constantly. I refer to myself as, I obviously identify with they, them pronouns, but there's almost the societal conditioning that they must mean plural, that I refer to myself in plurals.
Mm-hmm.
So I also refer to myself as third person a lot. So I'll be like, oh, Asher feels great today. Or we're doing this today. We being myself. Because I'm so programmed in my head that they must be plural. That even my butterflies, like I said, they're plural. Because I don't know if it's one. I don't know if it's 20. And how, even if it is one, it's probably a they. Because butterflies don't have gender. There's no social construct around butterflies.
I'm curious. Do you think, Do you think that you are made a better writer by using, by being able to integrate that kind of, to be able to so easily integrate yourself and the kinds of things that you're thinking about into your writing, whether that's through language and through the use of pronouns and like mm-hmm. that? Do you think that that makes you a stronger writer in the end?
I wouldn't necessarily say better.
Yeah.
I don't like saying that I'm better than anybody else.
Yeah. Well, yeah,
I have this weird issue with power complexes. And I never want to see myself as higher than anyone else.
Well, I mean better than you would have been without it.
Yeah, I think like definitely compared to myself, having this self-awareness of my gender definitely makes me stronger and definitely like mm-hmm. puts me ahead of where I would have been if I was still in the closet.
Mm-hmm.
It definitely like takes this, it's made me more self-reflective as to look at my gender. And so having they and being they like shapes everything in my life, and it's really cool to be able to express that in any way, shape, or form.
Would you be willing to talk a little bit about how you came back to poetry? You know, you mentioned before the show that even as an elementary school student, you were interested in poetry. Mm-hmm. And then there was this kind of long stretch where it kind of fell by the wayside a little bit. And I, you know, I'm really interested in this story because it's tied kind of directly to this thing that we offer at the high school and this type of field trip and experience that we do. And I just think it's such a cool, uplifting mm-hmm. concept that, you know, kind of how you came back to poetry. If you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. So in fifth grade, I started writing about some really dark stuff. And then I wrote a little bit until about like middle of eighth grade. And then it like dropped off. Right. I still went to slams and open mics in Spokane all the way until like freshman, sophomore year. Sophomore year, I dropped off the face of the earth writing wise. Like, I was done. And then I was done for a while, like 2 years almost.
Not watching slam videos online.
No.
For folks who are listening and you're not familiar, spoken word and slam, there's kind of similar genres. If we had to define it, I don't know, modern poetry about topics the poet really cares a lot about. And
poetry that inflection matters.
That's a good way to describe it.
Yeah. Poetry with inflection.
So you weren't watching slam videos.
No, I wasn't.
You weren't. You kind of just.
I was totally
disconnected,
uninvolved.
Unplugged.
And then I was told about this field trip at Astoria High School shortly after I moved here. I just moved here last January. And I heard about this field trip, Verslandia, to go to this big poetry slam competition in Portland. And I'm like, hold on. This sounds really cool. And this is something that I used to be so passionate about. Now that I'm in a new environment, now that I feel like I'm a better version of who I was, why can't I get back into it? And
cool.
So I went to the field trip. And on the way there, I was so excited. I'm like, this is
because you knew what was coming.
Yeah.
You knew how cool it was. A lot
yeah.
of the kids that went, you know, they had no idea what they were in
no.
for. And it's the largest teenage poetry competition in the state of Oregon. It's
yeah.
at the Arlene Schnitzer every year. It's just this really powerful event.
Yeah, so on the way back even, I had my phone out and I was writing little blurbs about things that made impact to me, things that I would want to elaborate on, thoughts that someone else had that I'm like, I think in a similar way. How can I express how I think that?
Wow.
Yeah, and it was this
revolutionary
The
idea. Next day, did you just, you were, it kept going, the momentum was there,
yeah.
you just kept writing and writing.
And
writing.
Ever since then, I filled a journal a month with poetry.
So cool.
Yeah. So I've just been so involved in this now community. I've turned it into my senior project even.
So that's a great segue into what we can kind of close with here. Tell us a little bit about this senior project and what's happening in April and how you're kind of trying to bring poetry to the community here in kind of some new ways.
Yeah, so my senior project is I created the Creative Writing Club at Astoria High School. I wanted it to be a poetry club, but I figured that was too narrow. So I expanded it to creative writing. And it's leading up to an event on April 18th at Astoria High School. I'll get more info out as it gets closer. I'm still a little weary on times. But it'll be Astoria's only poetry slam.
And for folks who don't know what a poetry slam is, basically, what does this entail?
It's like a spoken word kind of competition. Where poets get up and they read whatever they feel is the closest to them, whatever they identify the strongest with.
So it's like an open mic with where people are scored on their performances. Yeah. And for folks who have never been, they are so thought-provoking. And so, open mics are great too. I love open mics. But there's something about adding this kind of competitive element to it. Mm-hmm. It's just really engaging, really interesting. So April 18th at the high school will be this poetry slam. It's for students and members of the community to not only watch, but also compete in, right? Mm-hmm. If folks do want to attend this or compete, should they get in touch with you? Are you still trying to sort that out?
I'm still trying to sort it out a little bit.
Okay.
Maybe, I will get flyers up around town as it gets closer.
Cool.
There's definitely going to be flyers in Godfather's where I work. There'll be one on the bathroom door as soon as I get things ready.
Cool.
Well,
I'm looking forward to that event. I know that, it's something that trying to find ways for more students to write and for more people to watch and see performance and, and see people read their writing. I just think it's a positive thing.
Yeah.
Cool. Asher Clover, thank you so much for coming in. And if anybody is interested in attending that event on April 18th, keep your eyes peeled for more info around town.
For a little teaser, I have a YouTube channel under Asher Clover.
Okay.
That has my piece that I was just talking about the Sistine Chapel.
Cool.
It has that piece uploaded on it if anybody wants to take a look at that.
Cool. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
So this is the portion of the show where I offer my student perspective on our in-studio guest today. And one of the things that I think was captured really well in this interview was the fact that language can completely change the way that we approach issues about identity, about race, about gender, things like that completely are altered by the words we use to describe them. Like Asher had talked about, the pronoun they to mean a singular person or thing is a new thing to the English language, and it was actually just recently Webster's Word of the Year was the singular they. And what I think this does is emphasize the importance of the way we choose words to describe ourselves. Our language is just a tool to describe our feelings, our emotions, and our thoughts. And the problem with tools is that they don't always fit every single job. And that's why we have things like music, like visual art, like photography, because there are feelings we as human beings experience, but we cannot communicate to others through words. And what I think is particularly interesting is that we can change our words to better fit the problems that we're facing, like LGBTQIA+ rights, like civil rights. If we simply change the way we express our ideas, we might be able to tackle those issues with more efficacy and more respect to the people around us. And the other thing that I think Asher captured really well in this interview was the fact that language becomes so ingrained in the way that we perceive ourselves and the way we perceive the world around us. That is, if we don't have the right words to describe things for other people, they might miss things as big as people. Like, for example, Asher pointed out that she would be lost without the word they. She wouldn't be able to find her identity without the word they. The word they as a singular pronoun allowed somebody to come to terms with their identity. Imagine what it would be like for Asher without the word they used in that specific context. And that speaks to the importance of language as an ever-evolving tool. Language from one day to the next will never be the same because people from one day to the next will never be the same. So all in all, I think it's incredibly important to think deeply about the words that we choose to describe things, experiences, emotions, because it can completely change our relationship with others. It can completely change our relationship with ourselves, and it can completely change the way we think about solving problems. Having the right words at our disposal gives us the opportunity to see issues, topics, in new lights that we couldn't before. And for those reasons, language is one of the most important things in our daily lives. And I think it would behoove us to take it seriously.